Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So, that happened. This week, let's talk about you. What kind of stuff do you like to read on HuffingtonPost.com? And how do we provide it when Congress takes off a day early to avoid a snowstorm? Senior politics editor Paige Lavender will explain. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court took up a challenge to Obamacare. If you like your health insurance, will you get to keep it? We talked to healthcare reporter Jeff Young about how nine people in robes could become the Affordable Care Act's final death panel. Finally, you might have heard that Scott Walker doesn't know whether President Obama is a Christian, but did you know that Scott Walker kicked labor unions in the balls this week? Labor reporter Dave Jamieson tells us all about it. I'm Arthur Delaney, and here's what happened first. All right, welcome back to So That Happened. I'm Arthur Delaney, filling in this week for Jason Linkins, and I'm joined by Paige Lavender. Say hello, Paige.
Hi, hello, Paige.
Paige is Paige edits the politics page.
I do.
And she is one of several people who does that, but right. I believe you are the senior most.
The senior most, yes. That's true. I've been doing it the longest of the group that does it now.
How long have you been doing it?
Going on 4 years now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
We've also got with us Jeff Young. Also, you may know him actually by his byline, Jeffrey Young.
That's right. I'm very formal in writing.
And he is our senior healthcare reporter.
Well, actually, John Cohn is older than I am, so I guess that makes him the senior healthcare reporter.
In the senior citizen sense. But in terms of seniority within the company, I don't think he's leapfrogged you.
No. It's going to take him longer than a month. I've been here 3 years.
Yeah. I think you're the senior healthcare reporter.
Sure. I'll take it.
And right. it was a huge week for healthcare. We'll come to that. But before we get there, I want to talk about the weather. Because we had some awesome weather this week. It snowed.
It was a very pretty snow if you were inside looking out.
Yeah, most of us were, weren't we?
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing all day until it stopped snowing and I went out to shovel and then it wasn't so pretty anymore.
Yeah, outside it was kind of a slushy snow, the kind that seeped into your boots as quickly as possible. I did not appreciate the slushiness of it.
You know, I, if either of you or anyone listening has any advice, I have a snow-related dilemma I can't figure out how to solve.
This is the place for that.
All right, yeah, that's right. So my neighbor two doors down just doesn't shovel his walk.
Just doesn't do it. Yeah.
So for the last 2 weeks, it's been treacherous ice or giant piles of snow, made worse, in my view, in a moral sense, by the fact that there's a grade school right next to our houses and a church that old ladies go to right around the corner.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, I'm trying to figure out what sort of criminal charges I can bring against this dude. He owns a business right across the street, and they shovel the walk there.
He actually would be subject to fines under District of Columbia law within a certain number of hours after snow stops falling. You are supposed to shovel, unless he's a renter, in which case it's
no, he
landlord.
Owns the building.
Here's what you actually should do, though. You should just shovel it for him.
It's way too much.
Oh, it's a lot.
He's got the corner house, so it goes all the way. Hmm. So I guess that just to close this off, do you think there's an exception to the stop snitching rule when it has to do with snow and ice?
Before snitching, I would put an anonymous note through his door, like, hey, shovel, man.
Yeah.
A note. That's the way I would go.
So You mentioned that it was beautiful from inside.
Yes.
We were all inside. A lot of people got a snow day. Kids didn't have to go to school. Mm-hmm. But the politics page doesn't stop
That's
working.
That's true.
And none of us really has an excuse to stop working. We all have to, quote, work from home because we have an internet job.
Right. Many people here work from home even when it is not snowing out.
Who even came in here on that day? It was Thursday when we had the big storm.
I don't know. Interns.
It was just interns.
Yeah, interns, I think, it made up the whole crew here.
We have really good interns.
Yeah.
We do pay our interns in case anyone's wondering.
But, I mean, in the defense of the rest of us, the interns live here in the office. They don't... So they don't have to go anywhere.
They sleep in the net.
Right, we have those cubbies.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're not impressed that they were here. Anyway, no one came in, but everyone had to work. Mm-hmm. I worked a lot. My wife was kind of goofing off. So I didn't fully enjoy the snow day like I did in my childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not the same. I actually was thinking yesterday that I kind of am sad that I chose a profession where I don't really get a snow day.
Cause... Now, when you're running the politics page, you use your laptop attached to a giant screen.
Yes, when I'm here. But when I'm home, it's just my laptop.
Okay.
Just the one.
And so... What was that like? I mean, was it harder or?
It sucks. It's hard to be a little focused on a snow day because no one's focused. Everybody wants to like.
It was a goof.
Right. Everybody wants to watch the snow and like drink hot chocolate and do whatever you do. Curl up on the couch and watch Indiana Jones, which I actually did do while I was working yesterday. So I had that going on.
Why did you watch that film? Because
it was on TV and it's a classic.
And Harrison Ford was in the news this week.
I know. Yes. So fitting. So I was just prepping in advance for that Harrison
Ford. Did you know anything about this?
That's the whole reason I'm here. I've got the sense about things. No. I didn't know about Harrison Ford. No. It was just on TV and it was good. And who wants to watch, you know, news all day? MSNBC or Fox or CNN. Nobody.
So people might not realize because we have a very basic... front pages or verticals, as we call them, and the politics page is one of our biggest ones after the front page, mm-hmm. and it's essentially the same. And because it's so simple, I don't know if people realize how much sophisticated stuff goes into the way things are arranged on the page.
Yeah, we think about a lot of things when we put your news on the page.
News stories by me and Jeff, for example.
Right. We always put Arthur and Jeff at the very top of the page.
We appreciate that so much. I know sometimes I file a stinker and it just, out of
no,
pity,
that's okay.
You put it in that lower right-hand side.
I give everybody, even the stinkers get a little bit of play on the politics page.
That is
somebody
so nice.
Wants to read it, so... no, we just think about, you know, obviously what the big news is because, you know, when there's news, we have to cover it for the sake of it just being news. And then we also, you know what our readers like to read. You know, we have an audience that loves to read about politics affecting actual human beings and not just, you know, hearing about the goings on, like, from the Hill. It's kind of boring to read just about legislation happening or whatever. So, you know, whenever we have real people stories, we feature those pretty heavily. And, yeah.
We had a couple real people stories this week
in
particular that people clicked on a whole lot. What were a couple of those?
We had a few. So one that was a little more fun was our reporter Dana Liebelson. Is that how you say her name?
Dana Liebelson.
I never say anyone's name right.
We can
so just wanted
that.
To make sure.
We'll edit that out.
The first three letters of her name spell lie.
Lie.
You don't say it that way.
Liable.
That's how I remember.
Oh, okay.
Or lie and then libel. This is not good.
I know.
Why did we hire her?
Listen, it's Liebelson, you guys.
Anyway, she wrote a great story all about how she's never smoked weed, which is fascinating in itself, but also she went to a weed convention, I think, here in D.C. and tried to score some legal weed because it's legal now, and I think she had a very hard time with it, but her, just like the whole piece was very funny and very popular among our readers, you know, both on the page and everybody was sharing it on Facebook and Twitter. Like I said, it's fascinating in itself that she's gotten this far in life without
smoking.
They
don't sell weed at the weed convention.
Right. You have to go through a process to get weed in D.C. now. It's not like Colorado where you can just walk into a place.
Right.
Well, for most people, the process is still buying it illegally from a drug dealer.
It's cheaper that way.
Well, it's also, I mean, there's only the medical dispensaries, the standards are really high, much higher than – it's sort of a funny thing. The district's medical marijuana law was – passed so long ago that it's super strict because it was passed when that was still a new thing. Congress blocked it for, what, 10, 15 years?
Yeah.
And then when it finally went through, the rest of the country who had passed medical marijuana laws passed much more permissive ones.
They lapped us.
Yeah, right, exactly. But we can't change it. Well, because Congress will block it again, much as they've sort of – we're in this weird gray legal area right now with possession of recreational weed where district law says it's legal, but Congress says it still isn't.
Mm-hmm. So Dana's piece really underscored that despite legalization and all its wonders, there just isn't enough marijuana. Marijuana isn't just blooming on the sidewalks.
Yeah.
You can't get – what else was hot on politics?
Well, we also had a lot of coverage of what was going on with the Ferguson, the DOJ's report on Ferguson, rather, which really laid out a lot of the underlying racism that's there. But what a really good piece that we had actually last night, which for those listening was Thursday, our reporter in Ferguson, Mariah, had a piece about – so we have this reporter, and she has a six-year-old kid. And
Mariah Stewart.
Mariah Stewart. Thank you. Sorry. She Mariah Stewart and her child were at a fast food restaurant. And I can't remember the one. But and she saw this drunken white man just shouting terrible things at another person who was in this drive-thru line, a black woman, I think. And
the guy, the woman behind her was being screamed at by this dude in a truck behind the woman.
I think she threatened to call the cops, and he said, "Call them twice, I'm white," which is really like, you could read everything that there is to be written about the DOJ's Ferguson report, but I mean, that one sentence alone really sums up the big issue there that they have. And so that was a really popular piece that we had.
And that was the insight of the piece, that the fact that this guy felt free to say, "Call the police," said everything.
Right. He was like, and not just the yelling and the fact that he was like, you know, essentially harassing this woman, but he was also visibly drunk in public. I think he might have been the one driving the car. So there were a lot of things going on in this situation. And she wrote about it, too, also, you know, thinking about the whole time this is happening. Her six-year-old kid was there, like, very intimidated by the whole thing. And it really just takes a lot of the stuff you read about in the news with, you know, police and how they treat people, and specifically in Ferguson, and it gives it a face, you know, and it makes it a little more understandable, I think.
And so that first-person, real human being perspective is characteristic of a type of story that's typically successful on the politics page. Yeah. It really relates the politics to what's going on.
Yeah, people like to read about other real people. You know, like I said, it's kind of boring to read about, you know, a piece of legislation. But then when you read about the effects of that happening to someone, it's like, you know, oh, crap, that could happen to me, too. And it's a little more relatable.
Probably the biggest story of the week was also something that a lot of people can relate to as human beings, the Supreme Court Affordable Care Act case. And Jeff Young, you were there inside the court.
Yeah, and just to sort of try to segue from what we were just talking about, you know, what makes this case so consequential, and I think arguably more consequential than the previous Supreme Court cases involving the Affordable Care Act, is that millions and millions of people are already signed up for this insurance. You know, 2012, when there was a constitutional question about the law's individual mandate, no one had been subject to any of it yet. It was all sort of theoretical.
Yeah.
And if that case had gone the other way, it would have screwed up the insurance market, but not nearly as badly as this case would. And just for people who haven't been following it, to try and make this arcane stuff as simple as possible, you know, if you make up to four times the poverty level, you can get subsidies for your health insurance on these exchanges from the Affordable Care Act. There's one in every state. But in 34 states, the federal government is running the exchanges instead of the state because the state officials decided not to do so. It's mostly Republican states, but there are some exceptions like Delaware and Illinois, New Jersey, where they're either Democratic or split, where they didn't do it for whatever reason. Anyway, this lawsuit says that because of the way one phrase in the statute is worded, the federal government isn't allowed to give those subsidies to people in states that don't have state-run insurance exchanges.
It's right. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
But also, to build on the whole human thing, you did such a great piece this week, and I'm not just, like, tooting your horn here, but but you had such a good piece with, you know, six people telling how, you know, how this you know, they're following this so closely because it affects them.
Right. So there are something on the order of, what, 8 million people in those 30-some states who have this kind of insurance right now. And about 85% or so of those people are subsidized. So Sam Stein and I talked to six of those people in six different states just about what the insurance means to them and what they would do without the subsidies. And, you know, what we found was, in a way, obvious. Most of those people would have to drop the insurance because they couldn't afford it without the subsidies. Their income's too low and the insurance is too expensive. But even the cases, one guy in particular where, you know, this guy had a history of cancer and he needs regular checkups for skin cancer. He said, well, I'll have to keep buying it. Another guy has a heart condition and he's going to need a major surgery sometime in the next year or so. And he said the same thing. Well, whatever I'll have to buy it. So it might sound like in that case that those guys will be okay. Well, they'll figure it out. I guess they don't need the subsidies that much anyway. But setting aside how disruptive that would be to their lives and people talking about taking second jobs just to pay for their insurance, which again was part of what the Affordable Care Act was supposed to stop. But it gets even more complicated and worse in a way because one of the consequences, if the court rules that these subsidies aren't legal and they end, they'll just stop going out. It could be
like
soon
immediately.
As, it could be immediately.
This year.
Justice Alito suggested maybe they could give states and Congress some time to figure out some way to smooth the transition to something else. I don't know if that would work, but it's on the table, I guess. But so the immediate consequence would be, as I said before, people would lose the subsidies and most of them would lose their insurance. But in a case like I was just saying with this guy who needs heart surgery, well, he's going to keep the insurance. He's going to get the heart surgery, right? If only people like him are buying the insurance, the prices are going to go up. And then a year later, a whole bunch more people won't be able to afford it and they'll stop buying it. And then that cycle will continue until there's not very many people left in there and they're paying through the nose.
Something that's the death spiral.
That's called a death spiral in the industry jargon. And it's not
that's
just
good
a
jargon.
It's not just a theoretical thing. In New York State, especially in a few other places, you know, a decade or two ago, they passed some regulations saying, look, insurance companies can't turn down anybody and they have to charge everybody roughly the same amount of money for their premiums regardless of their medical history. So that sounds great in theory, but the result was lots of people with major health problems signed up for insurance and people who were just buying it for peace of mind couldn't afford it. To the point where when Obamacare took effect at the beginning of last year, health insurance premiums in New York State went down by 50% on average because they were so high before. So you could see the same situation in 34 states.
Yeah. No, let's have a 30,000-foot view of this challenge to the law. It's a law called the Affordable Care Act. And what the plaintiffs are saying is that Congress did not really intend for health care to be affordable for these people?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two big parts of the suit. The first and easiest part to explain, even though it sounds crazy, is that there's a line in the law that makes it look like what they're saying is true, right?
Established by a state.
Right. It says an exchange established by a state. Okay, well, you know, if you isolate that out, you could say, well, I'm sorry, it says what it says. And that's basically what Justice Scalia said is, look, you know, what Congress meant to do is not my concern. I'm paraphrasing here. But if that's the law they wrote, that's the law they wrote. You know, and if you can't get around that, well, then that's just what it is. And Congress certainly isn't going to fix this. They could have any time over the last 5 years, and they didn't. But the secondary part of the plaintiff's case here is that this is what Congress always intended. They only wanted subsidies to go to state-run exchanges.
And that's what sounds very crazy.
And, you know, I read their briefs. I saw the arguments yesterday. I also covered the writing of this legislation and its implementation closely.
Yeah.
And that's just not true. Like, it just isn't. And the court didn't seem – the justices, for the most part, during the oral arguments this week, didn't really talk about that very much. That is that I didn't hear a lot from, say, the conservative justices accepting as true this narrative built into the plaintiff's case, which, again, I believe is just false. Nor did I hear a whole lot from the liberal justices saying, hey, by the way, this thing you put in there is totally made up. There was a little bit of that.
Wait, so that wasn't part of the argument? I thought that was the core of the case.
Well, no. In a legal sense, they have to look at, you know, what does that phrase that is the center of this, what does it say, uh-huh. and what is it meant to signal, right? It seemed that the justices were mainly concerned with that. And then whether one interpretation, the plaintiffs, that this was intended to push states to make their own exchanges by saying, if you don't, we're going to deny financial assistance to your citizens while still regulating the health insurance markets in your state in such a way that will cause prices to rise. Or the government's position, which is what, no, that's crazy. This was supposed to be for the whole country. It's pretty damn obvious if you look at the bill and everything we ever said about it ever. But the justices were talking about, if we accept one of those interpretations, what are the implications for the states? What are the
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Implications for the relationship between the federal government and the states on a constitutional basis.
Yeah.
And then if you accept the government's version, well, what does that say about the relationship between the federal government and the states? It was hard to tell, really, how this was going to play out.
I thought people said Anthony Kennedy would do the classic swing justice thing and side with the liberals.
Right. Well, going into it, you know, I mean, the Supreme Court is so predictably partisan about most things that there are 9 of them, and essentially 7 at all times are considered locks for one way or another, or maybe more. Maybe I should say 6.
Yeah.
You know, the 3 most liberal ones and the 3 most conservative ones, you can pretty much count them to fall on the other side, which leaves 3 people in the middle, roughly, including Chief Justice John Roberts. Going into this particular case, Roberts and Kennedy were kind of seen by people who know more about this stuff and how the court works than I do as the ones who were relatively more likely to side with the government in this case and against the plaintiffs in a way that would preserve the way Obamacare is operating right now.
All right. Well, now just predict what's going to happen. Just say it.
I can't.
Come on. Yes,
no.
You can't.
So what I will say is this, and I've been thinking this all along, and this is really vague, or maybe that's the wrong word for it, but, you know, if you remember back 3 years ago, the Supreme Court had a chance to seriously damage the Affordable Care Act before it had really gone into effect. And John Roberts went out of his way to not do that.
And everyone was surprised. People predicted.
Right.
Our own Supreme Court reporter at that time said, walked out of the oral argument, said, this sucker's going down.
Right.
And he was famously wrong.
So John Roberts ended up voting with the 4 liberals in that case and wrote an opinion kind of surprising people by deciding that the individual mandate was constitutional because Congress is allowed to tax people, which was not really a main part of the argument at the time. Mm-hmm. So my thinking is, and again, this is silly, but I've been thinking all along, John Roberts had a chance to kill this thing 3 years ago, and he chose not to and went to great lengths to do so and made a lot of people very upset, right? People who would normally like him and agree with him. So why do it now, especially in such a weird way over such an arcane dispute about how to interpret a 6-word phrase in a statute that's like 900 pages
long? So you're predicting he won't do it. That's great.
I just don't know. And as far as Kennedy goes, you know, there are some elements here that people saw of the argument that people thought he'd be sympathetic toward the plaintiffs. And one of them was that – toward the government. And one of them is that the plaintiffs' argument – would mean that the Congress wrote a law that is unconstitutionally coercive to states. As Kennedy said, to paraphrase, to the plaintiff's lawyers, like, well, based on what you're saying, the rule here from Congress is enact an exchange in your state at expense and trouble to you, the state, or we will destroy your health insurance market. And then Congress – and then no one ever actually told the states that.
They didn't.
Right.
I was there, so, too. It wasn't a thing.
The reason everyone zeroed in on that is that people were looking to Kennedy and Roberts for any kind of sign that they would do something other than just vote on a partisan basis, and he gave one.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to vote to preserve – the Affordable Care Act. We just can't really know. Also,
ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here first. Jeff Young predicted the Supreme Court will uphold Obamacare. Our own magical eight ball.
Yeah, sure, why not?
All right. All right, Jeffrey Young has tagged out for labor reporter Dave Jamieson. Dave, say hello.
Hello.
Dave has been covering Scott Walker, one of the heroes of the politics page. a major bringer of clicks.
Yeah.
And Dave actually went out to Wisconsin.
Scott Walker is the hero of the politics, right?
Hero in one sense, perhaps villain to some.
No, I wanted to be clear that I'm not the hero, that Scott Walker is the hero.
It's definitely not you. It's definitely Scott Walker.
You're one of his helpers.
His minions.
I do carry his message, absolutely.
You do. And Scott Walker's been huge in particular, I think mainly because he's got presidential contender status. And some people might be missing what he's actually doing. Not Dave Jamieson, though. Dave Jamieson was there.
Yeah, people are really passionate about Scott Walker. And we're seeing those passions again this week. The Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin were fast-tracking this right-to-work bill, and we can get into a little explaining of what exactly right-to-work is. But this was kind of a small-scale repeat of what we saw in 2011 when there
was massive protest.
The massive protests when Walker and Wisconsin Republicans were stripping collective bargaining rights from the public sector workers. This time they're going after the private sector unions, and it was interesting being out there, and you can visibly see kind of how diminished the organized labor is there. You know, there was like 100,000 people out there in 2011.
Huge protest.
I mean, this was like kind of an inspiration for Occupy. That was like a huge,
I think it directly bequeathed the Occupy movement, Wisconsin protests.
It was the best, like, signal of some kind of labor resurgence, you know, in years. This time, there was a few thousand people each day as opposed to 100,000.
Well, wait a minute. Scott Walker, there were those big protests, and he licked them. He kicked their butts.
He did. He licked them, yeah.
They tried to recall him, and it didn't work.
They did. It did not work. He's still standing after all of that, and that's part of his aura and why he's such a hot shot on the right. But in terms of the right to work, which was just passed by the Wisconsin Assembly like an hour ago, so this thing is happening.
It happened this week on Friday.
Walker said he's going to sign it. So what right to work does, a lot of people don't know. First of all, the first thing to know is that right to work as a term is a right-wing creation, right? It sounds wonderful,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Like a really good thing.
Yeah, yes, I would appreciate having a right to work.
It's similar to like tort reform as a piece of language. It is kind of the right winning right off the bat, kind of winning the language war with this one. But what right to work does is, so say this office were unionized. Strictly theoretical, Ariana.
Oh, wow.
Strictly theoretical. If we were unionized, our union, say the United Aggregators of America, our union, the UAA, would have to represent everybody in here, whether the union, even if
Paige Lavender?
Say Paige voted against the union. Paige didn't want the union. But the union wins the election. Paige still has to be represented by the union. That costs money, right? So the UAA wants a contract with AOL that says everybody's got to chip in their share of fees to support the union, since the union's got a bargain for everybody. What Right to Work does is make contracts like that illegal. So they essentially give anybody the opportunity to opt out of paying their fair share fees to the union. So what happens then, say DC goes Right to Work. It'll never happen. But say DC goes Right to Work. All of a sudden, Page is like, sweet, here's my chance to stop paying dues, and I'm going to get that extra 1% in my paycheck.
Get a little raise.
Yeah. So Page drops out quietly. Then we have Artie looking over at Page, and he's like, well, if Page is out of here, then like, why should I be supporting the union? This is what unions call the freeloading problem, or free riding.
Yeah.
And so I'm standing over here, and I was rock solid before, but now I'm seeing other people drop out, and I'm actually watching our union get weaker. There's less the union can do. So then I actually have legitimate reason to be like, is this really worth my money?
So it's a death spiral.
That's in theory. That is the worst case scenario for unions, that it becomes a death spiral.
Well, and even with, like, if there are union diehards who, even if everyone else is leaving the union they're in, it doesn't it raise fees for them? It makes it more expensive for them to still be in it.
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, what it does is it makes a smaller, an ever shrinking portion of the unit is having to bear the load for everybody. Yeah, so it can lead to dues hikes down the road and that sort of thing. So this can be very problematic for unions. Indiana and Michigan passed their Right to Work laws in 2012. And Wisconsin doing this, you know, to like step back for a minute here. For like years and years, Right to Work was this thing that was just in the South and out West. You know, South is traditionally very anti-union. And there's a very, you know, a longstanding racial component to this, too, in the South. But recently, this stuff has been popping up in the Midwest. Michigan and Indiana both went Right to Work in 2012, and that's a huge deal, especially Michigan, the cradle of the auto industry. The UAW, always a huge union stronghold, goes Right to Work. Boom. And now, all of a sudden, you've got other states around them, like Wisconsin, who are saying, hey, our neighbors are Right to Work. We got to go Right to Work, too.
To be competitive.
Yeah, we got to be competitive, or businesses are going to flee, or they're not going to want to come here. They're going to go over the line to that state. So that's the argument you're seeing here, and there's a bit of a domino effect to it.
No one's in unions anyway outside the public sector. What is the rate of union membership?
It's about 6.6% in
the
private sector.
Oh, my God. That's low.
Yes. So the term big labor that you hear is kind of preposterous at this point.
Sort of a misnomer.
It is. These laws are going to in all likelihood, kind of diminish the union's private sector footprint even more.
So arguably, this is the most consequential Scott Walker news, but I don't think it's like the tallest peak in the landscape, the topography of Scott Walker news that we have seen in the past 2 weeks.
Not in the past 2 weeks, no. A lot of people, he refused to answer a question about evolution or something.
It's like he's gone out and deliberately done a series of gaffes.
Yes.
To give us clips.
Yeah, that's
he's
what it is.
Surrounded by rakes.
And he keeps stepping on them, but yeah. I think he does it on purpose. What can you fill us in on where he's at right now, Paige?
So while all of this was going down in Wisconsin, Walker wasn't even really there. He was in the UK for one thing. He kind of followed Chris Christie to London and did a trip abroad, and that's where he made the evolution comment, or rather didn't comment on it.
He said, I think, punt.
Yeah, he just punted. He literally said, I'm punting the question, and just didn't answer it. And then followed that up with a series of tweets, and so it turned into this like 2-day news story that people were following. And then after that, he was at CPAC, where he was very loved, and you know, he gave a speech there, and people generally accepted it in a good way. The CPAC attendees, I mean,
he is like here. They are happy because he's the plausible alternative to Jeb Bush,
right? Yeah, and especially after the whole like Christie Bridgegate thing and all of his troubles, now Walker seems to be a pretty solid. He's conservative. I mean, he proved with the 2011 stuff that he can stand up for conservative values and win. You know, he's got that to brag about now. So he's kind of a conservative rock star.
He has the social bona fides that better than Christie.
Yes.
conservatism.
Yeah. So he was kind of – he wasn't even in Wisconsin for a lot of this during the debate over the legislation and stuff. And
he had some other notable gaffe type.
The Christianity.
Yes. Yes. He said he did. Yeah. I forgot about that one. Thank you for the reminder.
Arguably the best of the bunch.
And it, well, I liked the evolution one personally. But yes, you're right that he said he didn't know if
Obama – I just don't know.
He said he didn't know if Obama loved America, I think was like what a lot of people really – grabbed onto was in which, you know, like, does your president love the country that he's president of is a little, I mean, to me, that's a dumb question.
But it became an argument with mainstream and liberal commentators ridiculing it and explaining how it could not possibly be so. And then, like, the National Review saying, you know what? Barack Obama doesn't love America.
And I think they even had other... You know, of course, when one person says something, everyone wants everybody else to weigh in. So I think you even had a lot of other potential 2016 candidates weighing in as well. You know, like, I don't know if – I think Bobby Jindal made some comments on it. Maybe.
But no one asked him, and Bobby Jindal said, hey,
yeah.
You know what? I also don't know. Don't look to me to settle
it's
this.
It's like, I'm still over here.
Well, we weren't, Bobby. We weren't looking to you.
Right.
But thanks.
That's the – yeah, that's why he said that. He wanted to make sure someone out there was looking at him because he's
the
still,
Christianity thing, yeah. I – like, Walker had a point to me personally. Like, I kind of agree with him when he says – this is a stupid question, and none of the people that I represent in Wisconsin really care about this thing. But the way to say that is when you're asked, is Obama a Christian? You say, of course he's a Christian. This is a stupid question. Why are you asking me this? Instead, yeah. He says he doesn't, you know, that he doesn't know. It was handled in a really weird, dumb way, but I think he had an underlying point that he could have made without kind of, you know, offending the president.
Well, and
basically.
On top of that, too, like, yeah, maybe he was saying, well, this is dumb, I'm not going to talk about it. But then didn't he send, like, a fundraising email saying, you know, look at me, how great I am for not answering this dumb question. Give me some money.
Do you not think that he deliberately wants to appear – he's putting himself in a position where it appears he is under attack by the media, that he doesn't want that?
He could want that. I mean, I don't – know that I can say definitively, yeah. But I think especially for a Republican, being as that the media is largely seen as a liberal monster, you know, it definitely doesn't hurt his case to have everybody on his case, you know.
Now, Dave, the right-to-work stuff that he's doing in Wisconsin, we know it, you know, because I guess it's complicated and takes more than one sentence to explain.
Actually, can I butt in? I would say for people listening, Dave did write a piece called How Right to Work Hurts Unions. Very, very good.
It clicked?
It clicked, but also I thought it was very good. No, yeah, it's not just about the clicks. It was a good explainer, especially, you know, if you haven't been following the news and you're like hearing about suddenly this right to work stuff, especially now that he's going to sign it, I'm sure it'll be more.
I should apologize to both of you. I mean, I just take it for granted that Dave's stuff is good, and I should not take it for granted that Paige was referring to the clicks.
No, I thought
it did click, right?
It did click, but also it's very good writing. A really good explainer.
Thank
I
you,
thought
Paige.
Yeah
so it was in, it was in the sweet here. Spot
so
how so where so okay all right where does the substantive policy achievement of Scott Walker fit in the overall story about him right now, where he's uncertain of Obama's Christianity and punts on a question about evolution?
Right to work is a great example of that, because we see over the years how Scott Walker has evolved on right to work. When he was a state legislator like 20 years ago, he actually put forth a right to work bill. As governor, he has dodged this over and over. He has said repeatedly, I think it would be a distraction. I have no interest in this.
Because Wisconsin's supposed to be a liberal bastion.
Here's the thing. Walker has called private sector unions his partner in economic development. The operating engineers are very powerful in Wisconsin, and they're very actually pretty conservative. They've endorsed Walker before. A lot of people thought he didn't want this, and the reason they thought he didn't want it is because he is already, like, you know, famous for breaking unions.
Do you need another feather in your cap,
Scott
Walker?
what everybody was telling me before this started happening was, oh, you know, there's no need to check the box again. And this is just going to bring all this heat again to Madison. They were wrong, of course.
The heat was gone.
Well,
you were there.
Yes.
And
I was there last week.
The heat looked small.
The heat was nothing like the heat in 2011. But Walker, so Walker proposed the right to work years ago. As governor, he's saying, I don't want this. It's not going to happen. He said in a debate with Tom Barrett, he said, this will never get to my desk. And Barrett said, mark my words. When it gets to his desk, he will sign it. And then, so this starts getting fast-tracked, and Walker says, yeah, I'll sign it. And now, to evolve even further, this week he was trying to take credit for it. You know, he was talking to a business lobby saying, you know, we brought this up. It's right to work's coming.
It was the same pattern with his union busting in 2011. He didn't campaign on it, period.
Yes.
And then he took it up with gusto eventually. Paige, I wonder if you think this. Let's let this be our final thought. As Walker's going forward and being a presidential person, is his habit of doing things that he did not say he would do at first, is that going to hurt him, or is it just not matter?
I wouldn't say it doesn't matter, but I don't know that it will hurt him to say, like, oh, I did right to work. And because, you know, like we just said, so many people were following other things in the news this week, not really paying attention to the whole right to work debate. Because we had that snowstorm, to bring it back to the beginning. And then so I think that for people who weren't following the story from day one, for him to stand up, let's say hypothetically, at a GOP primary debate for 2016 and say, oh, well, you know, we did right to work. I think a lot of people, you know, just generally watching it, casual followers of politics, won't really question it. And so it
only
help
people
him.
In Wisconsin know this stuff.
So it'll help him perhaps on his way through the all important and difficult, treacherous Republican primary.
Yes, I think that it will help.
All right. Thank you all for listening. Thanks, guys, for being here.
Yay, thanks.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki, with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta and Adriana Ucero. I'm Arthur Delaney, and this week we were joined by HuffPost senior politics editor Paige Lavender, healthcare reporter Jeff Young, and workplace reporter Dave Jamieson. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Check us out in the iTunes store for the Huffington Post's whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we miss you already. One take, Delaney.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.